it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
I'll bet you it's more unusual for a pro athlete or an executive to not have a burner account than to have a burner account. We've seen a case of an NBA general manager, now maybe a case of an NBA referee. And I'm going, well, I bet all the referees have burner accounts. I don't know. I have friends who say they're not on Twitter, that are in executive and professional positions, but then they know everything that's going on Twitter.
You think that more don't have one?
No, I think more
do have
one. I think there's a whole bunch of people. I'd be surprised, you know, I'd be more surprised that if somebody told me, hey, an NBA general manager who doesn't have a real Twitter account, that I'd be surprised if those people do not have burner accounts.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think I would be surprised if it's like not 75% of these general managers have burner accounts.
I think you're probably right. Brandon Huffman.
It's a good way to get false information out there, too.
Yeah. Or maybe they watch. They're twatchers, so to speak. Brandon Huffman. He's the national recruiting editor at 24/7 Sports. He lives in the Pacific Northwest. He's a man of the world. He's in the sunshine today. Where are you today?
I am sitting in my office just outside Seattle with the sun doing what it does best around this time, blinding me, coming through the window, and I don't care that it's blinding me.
I like that. Nice. I'm not one of those people either, Brandon, and I'm not one of those people that complains when it gets warm. Everybody's going, it's too hot. It's too hot too soon. It's not summer yet. I'm like, no. We can't complain about the rain and then turn around and complain about the heat.
I'm Southern California, born and bred, and trust me, it can never get too hot, but it can get too cold. That I will complain about.
Brandon, I want to talk about Aiden Childs to start with. And this is a kid you've seen throughout high school. You've seen him at camps and 7-on-7 tournaments and watched him up close. And Oregon State's got him. He's a freshman there. He's enrolled early. He may get some run here in fall camp for some real playing time. What have you seen of Aiden Childs?
You know, it's interesting. I actually went to college with his high school coach, and my brother was a teammate of his high school coach as well. And I remember him telling me about it about 2 years ago, saying, hey, I got this kid. At the time, his only offer was Houston Baptist, and that was largely because the head coach at Houston Baptist was his high school coach's college coach. So at that time, I'm like, hey, you know what? This kid's kind of got something. He's better than Houston Baptist, which is an FCS thing. This kid's at least a Mountain West kid. Then about a year ago, I saw him at a 7-on-7 tournament where he took a team that was not really that talented to the championship game, and he went because he didn't even get invited to the Under Armour camp in Southern California. He only had a Mountain West offer in addition to Houston Baptist. 2 months later, he's the MVP at the Under Armour camp. His recruitment just blows up, and then you just saw his stock continue to rise. And this is a kid in a position where a lot of these guys are single holdbacks, double holdbacks. He was young for his class, and he was overshadowed by Malachi Nelson, overshadowed by Nika Yamalieva. And, yeah, I compared it to C.J. Stroud. He was overshadowed by D.J. Uyunglele and Bryce Young and ended up becoming the second quarterback pick. I think Aiden Childs is going to have a similar arc where after being overshadowed for much of his high school career, you're going to see what a star he is in his time at Oregon State.
Give me an idea, because I think one of the concerns that coaches, not just at Oregon State, but nationally have with young players is that if they don't play them right away, maybe Dante Moore at UCLA is a different case, but if they don't play them right away, they risk losing them in the transfer portal by the time they're a sophomore. How big of a concern is that, you know, as you see kids talking about how fast they want it to happen?
You know, it's something that every college coach has to take into consideration when they're recruiting a high-caliber quarterback. But this is also a relationship that when they did recruit him, when Oregon State did get his commitment, Aiden was still a three-star. He wasn't an elite quarterback. He wasn't considered one of the elite quarterbacks. He wasn't a Dante Moore or a Nico or a Malachi Nelson where he had his pick, where you had to keep him happy. Aiden Childs was going to Oregon State with the understanding that they might have a returning starter this year. This is before DJ transferred in, but he also wasn't rushing himself. He also didn't feel like, hey, I need to go somewhere and I need to play right away. This is a kid that really had to wait until his junior year of high school to be the guy. So waiting and patience is something that has kind of made him what the quarterback he is. He didn't even get invited to the All-American Bowl until the last quarterback spot opened up as a result of an injury, and he goes down there and was probably the second-best quarterback there the whole week. So he's kind of used to waiting and just waiting his turn and then quietly getting better so that way when he is turned loose, he can be the guy. So even with DJ coming in, you know, he does it with the understanding like, hey, I can go in. There's not going to be the expectation on me to play right away. But if I am getting asked to play right away, I will be ready. And I think that's the one thing when you don't have to rush a kid, you can kind of bring him along a little bit slower, but make sure he's ready just without the immediate pressure and expectation. But I've seen Aiden Childs wait, and when he's waited his turn and been turned loose, that's when he's really flourished.
Give me an idea in that conversation where, you know, the player, the coach, the coaching staff, player's parents, high school coach, in that conversation, you know, are parents and families willing to be patient in your mind? Or do you hear kind of a chorus of, you know, we want to go somewhere where we're going to be able to play right away happening in football? I think basketball might be different.
No, I think it's funny how you say we, because that's how a lot of these families and kind of the people involved in a lot of the recruitments are. This is a we thing. This isn't a him thing. This isn't just the quarterback that you're recruiting. You're recruiting the whole package. You're getting mom and dad. You're getting the quarterback trainer. You're getting the other trainers, the high school coaches, the 7-on-7 coaches. You're getting the whole package, and a lot of coaches are turned off by that. Then there's a lot of coaches that understand that's a game you have to play, but then don't know what to do when they have to, when they're confronted by, you told us we were going to play early. Well, there's only one person that's going to play early. It's not all of you, it's him. And a lot of times it's not even the kid that wants to leave, it's everybody around him that wants him to leave because they perceive that they've been slighted, that he's not playing. And this is one of those recruitments where he wasn't at, you know, you look at Aiden Shaw's recruitment, he wasn't at a big glamour school at Downey High School. He was playing for a very humble high school coach who was a small college player of the year. You know, his mom was very involved in the recruiting process, but not to the extent where she was a detriment. She just was asking a lot of questions because it was so new to her. And I think that that is why they found such a great match with Oregon State. And also I think why Oregon State really targeted him as the guy, because there wasn't the need to make promises. There wasn't the need to guarantee he's going to be playing as a true freshman, or maybe even starting. It was a, hey, this is how our process works, and we'd love you to be a part of it. And there's that mutual trust on both sides, but not a lot of coaches are very good at that. And, you know, you look at the school that Jonathan Smith came from at Washington, he was kind of burned, Chris Peterson was kind of burned by making the guarantees to Jacob Easton when he transferred in from Georgia, and then losing Jake Haner. Jacob Easton didn't have great success. Jake Haner ends up a third-round draft pick by virtue of leaving to go to Fresno State, and everything worked out handsomely for him. That's the danger with sometimes making some promises that you don't necessarily need to make.
Chris Peterson's interesting to me, and you know him. You've talked with him often. I think we've had him on this show twice, but I don't have a sense of why he walked away. Do you think it was related to the complicated world and the way recruiting was changing, and it's less about teaching, or was it burnout? What's the sense you got in talking to Peterson over the years?
I think there was a slight bit of burnout, but I think it was heavily slanted towards he did not want to do what recruiting was becoming. He did not want to have to deal with the direction that recruiting was going. And remember, he announced his retirement a year and a half before NIL even went into effect, but it's almost like he foresaw that becoming a bigger part of the recruiting cycle. And you started to see, you know, what was happening in college football and across the country with more promises being made to schools, with, you know, more expectations from the players. If I'm going to come to your school, what are you going to give me besides this scholarship and, you know, guaranteed playing time? There was a want for more. And I just think that he was a guy who, in a sense, was a little bit of an old school traditionalist, like, hey, your scholarship should be enough for you. You should want to come here and play and represent this university, play major college football to put yourself in a position to play professionally. And with more and more college football programs looking like kind of mini professional operations, I don't think he wanted to make that transition. And I think with Stanford's job opening up last year, them certainly kicking the tires there, and at a school that there wasn't going to be the expectation to change their ways. He was still like, yep, I'm good. I'm fine sitting on the sidelines and just watching college football as it is. Maybe he becomes the first commissioner of college football if there ever is one. But I think he got out just in time, and I just don't see, with the way college football is changing, him returning anytime soon.
We're talking to Brandon Huffman. He is the national recruiting editor, 24/7 Sports. I've seen some schools, Ohio State probably doing this really well, that are selling more than just football. Like, we've always seen schools sell academics, but Ohio State kind of selling the idea that, hey, they can connect you with their network of people. And I know Oregon State, and some others have done this, but is that effective? Do kids care about, hey, it's not just going to school, it's not just playing in a conference, it's not just playing time and winning, but you can network with alumni if you go to Ohio State, or you can network at Stanford that way. Is that an effective tool that they use, or is it just part of, hey, when we recruit, we're going to recruit in every possible way we can?
Yeah, I think it's more the latter, because the reality is, with the portal becoming as rampant as it is, you're not really going to have those connections available to you if you transfer away from a school. So a school might do that in a selling point to, hey, get here, you're going to have the great connections, the alumni base. I mean, USC's been selling that for years, right? The Trojan family, where, you know, you're going to be able to find jobs. But now with guys coming and going into the portal as quickly as they got there, that's not the selling point that these kids are interested in. Now it's not hard to see that, the way college football is, it's what can you do for me now? I'm not concerned about what you're going to do for me in 5 years, what you're going to do for me in 20 years. The Stanford idea, it's the 40-year decision, not the 4-year decision. Yeah, Stanford's still probably going to get the majority of those kids being the 40-year decision. But the majority of college football players are like, I don't care what's going to happen when I'm 30 or 35. What are you going to do for me when I'm 18 or 19 or 20? How are you going to help me build my brand right now? And so that's another thing that Ohio State can sell, but it's easy to sell when you've got first round draft picks or 7 first round draft picks projected like they do next year. You're a frequent playoff team. And you also have your head coach getting out there and getting a raw number saying, you need $12 million now to put together a recruiting class. He's not coming up with a $12 million number just randomly. That was as much of a call to arms to get his boosters and his collective in gear so that they can compete with a lot of these schools. That's what Ohio State's really selling. That's what Ohio State and all the other college football teams are really selling. They're trying to add the alumni to take the pressure off the collective, the pressure off themselves to say our collectives are running things. But at the end of the day, the teams that are signing the best classes, that are getting the best transfers, they're the ones that have pretty active collectives and are helping these guys on the front end.
Brandon Huffman is with us. I know I've asked you this on the podcast that we did with John Wilner the other day, but I want you to maybe help our listeners understand, you know, within the Pac-12 conference, is all recruiting the same, or is Oregon doing something differently? And I'm looking at the guys that they are signing and going, gosh, they're all over the country.
It's what they're doing is they're capitalizing on the national brand that they have become in the last 10 to 12 years. I mean, yes, you can think back to, you know, when Joey Harrington's banner hung in Times Square, but the high school kids, the seniors right now, they were 5 years before they were even born at that point. So they don't know the national brand, but they remember the Marcus Mariota year. My son is an average high school football player. He's a 2024 class. The first year he really started getting into college football was 2012, 2013. So most seniors in high school, most juniors in high school to be in football, when they started really watching college football in their later elementary years, they watched Marcus Mariota win a Heisman. They saw Oregon play for a national championship. They've seen Justin Herbert win a Rose Bowl and now flourish in the NFL. So they've got this national brand. And when they don't have a fertile recruiting ground in their backyard, like a lot of the other states in the Pac-12 do, they can recruit nationally. Then you bring in a coach who came from Georgia, who came from recruiting that Southeast and came from building a national championship squad defensively from those Southern ties, and you have coaches that have had experience all over the country, you're going to tap into those regions. And that's no surprise why you see them go in to an Oklahoma to get as a Davian Sands, why they're able to go, you know, into Pennsylvania for recruits, why they're able to go into Texas, into the Southeast, because they've got coaches that have come from all over the country and they are a national brand. It's not Oregon's on the other side of the country. It's Oregon's a school that's putting guys in the league. They're playing in big time games. They're playing against big time opponents. They're playing on television week after week. They've got the Nike connection, but it's all of those things. And Oregon is really knowing how to capitalize on all those things.
Now, Brandon, I'm not going to hold you responsible if, you know, because we're just going to spitball here. But I keep hearing about NIL deals, and I hear, you know, at first it was like Cam Ward. I know he got $90,000 package from Washington State, and then we see Michael Penix Jr. go back to Washington. We see Bo Nix at Oregon, and I think to myself, what could that be worth? And I don't really have a grasp of what those guys are getting. Do you have a range when it comes to a lockdown corner, a defensive tackle, a star quarterback? Are we talking $100,000, $500,000, $1 million? You know, what is an NIL deal worth in that world?
You know, it kind of mirrors what the NFL is doing, and you're seeing the elite quarterbacks are commanding bigger NIL deals. They're going to be the face of your program. They're going to sell the most jerseys. They're going to be the ones that you want at the local Dodge dealership to sign autographs and take pictures for a couple hours. But then you're seeing pass rushers, left tackles, lockdown cover corners. They're probably in that next tier of compensation in NIL packages. And much like the NFL, where the running back position has been devalued, where you're not seeing as many first-round draft picks at running backs, running backs aren't getting the NIL deals that receivers are getting, that tight ends are even getting, which it's funny when you look back 10, 15 years ago and you think about some of the great players in college football in the NFL, they were running backs. Now that position's been devalued. So the NIL deals are going to the faces of the program, those quarterbacks, those lockdown corners, those franchise left tackles. Thank you, you know, the blind side for making that position that much more valuable. Those elite pass rushers. And there's kind of becoming a clear case of the haves and the have-nots positionally of what these guys are making. But then there's a lot of incentive if you're a returning quarterback who could go to the NFL. You might be a third-round pick. You might be a fourth or fifth-round pick, and you might not get the guaranteed contract depending on where you're slot. But you can come back, get one more year of glory, and maybe you put your stock a little higher, but that NIL deal you're coming back to college for is going to be worth more than being the quarterback, maybe the scout team quarterback on a team you got drafted in the fifth round. So you're seeing that there's some schools that they're not playing the NIL game on the signing, on the recruiting side of it. They're playing it on the, you produced for our program for 3 or 4 years. We want to keep you for one more year, so we're going to give you the NIL. Then you're seeing the other schools that are making it very clear, hey, we've got such a talent depletion here. We're going to give all of the recruits this great NIL package to get them here. And then hopefully the overwhelming talent, even our coaches can't screw that up.
Brandon, you know, the Jonathan Smith approach with his coaching staff has largely been, you know, keep the coaching staff together. Retention, very important to that staff. I'm curious from your vantage point, is there a downside to that? Do you need new ideas? Do you need young assistants when it comes to recruiting? And is there any danger in retaining your staff for 4, 5, 6, 7 years?
No, because I think if you look at the program in the Pac-12 that's been the most consistent since the Pac-12 expanded to 12 teams, it's the University of Utah. And where has there been probably the least amount of turnover in recent years? It's been at the University of Utah. You're seeing those coaches being courted. I mean, we saw Marcus Freeman in Notre Dame make this huge effort to try to woo Andy Ludwig away from Utah, purposely going to a Notre Dame hockey game so he could be on the Jumbotron. And then Andy Ludwig decided to stay at Utah. And why is Utah as good as they are now? Because there's a consistency in the coaching staff. There's a consistency in a head coach who's been there for 18 years and doesn't show any signs of either slowing down or leaving. But you're also seeing very little turnover in his assistant coaches. When a coach is recruiting a kid and he says, I'm going to be here for the next 4 or 5 years, Utah has shown a track record that that coach is going to be there for the next 4 or 5 years. And you have coaches at Oregon State, a Trent Bray, a defensive coordinator, you know, who may someday be the next head coach at Oregon State, but it might not be for 15 or 20 years because Jonathan Smith could be there for the next 15 to 20 years. But he's an Oregon State alum. He's a coach's kid himself. He understands, like, continuity helps. You get a guy like Jim Mihalchik, who's been in the NFL, who's been around the Pac-12, but he's a Northwest guy. He played at Washington State. He's from the state of Washington. He's close to the rivers and the streams and the mountains like he wants to be. He's on the back end of his coaching career, but he's showing those flies are slowing down, and you're seeing them have one of the best offensive lines. And so when you have that consistency, you're not losing guys to a lot of lateral moves. When you're losing coaches, a lot of those guys are leaving for the NFL like a Michael Petrie did, and they're able to keep a good chunk of those coaches happy and staying there. And I think when you have that consistency in your program and your coaching staff, your program benefits from that. And I think Oregon State's entering into a very exciting period if you're an Oregon State fan, of just being one of that consistent teams that you're always going to be able to count and go into a bowl and compete for some conference championships.
All right, Brandon, I really appreciate your time. Follow him on Twitter. Read him at 24/7 Sports. Enjoy the sunshine, my friend.
I will. I'm going to go put my sunglasses on in my office just as a result of that.
There you go. That's what I need. I need a window that faces the sunshine in this studio. The sunshine, it's always shining in this studio. What am I talking about? I think it's really an interesting conversation because I think on one hand, I see it as a huge positive that you get retention. Remember Oregon's coaching staff for years under Rich Brooks, Mike Bellotti, and then later Chip Kelly, Mark Helfrich, the same assistant coaches 28 years. It was celebrated as, hey, this is great. But I talked to Mike Bellotti a few weeks ago, and he said, you still need some good ideas, which he got by sort of rotating characters in and out of the offensive coordinator position. He went from Andy Ludwig and Gary Croton to Chip Kelly, and he found something there. All right, coming up, we'll talk more about the burner account that everybody's talking about. Is it really a burner account? Leave it here. You got the BFT. There are times when I feel like my children are more evolved than I am. Is that a bad thing for me to say? Am I a bad dad if I say that out loud? And what I mean by that is, like, my 20-year-old who's in college, she is a she grew up with Instagram and TikTok and Snapchat and whatever else social media wise that the rest of us sort of inherited and had to understand. And because she grew up with it, I think there are certain facets of social media that she understands, like, inherently better than I do naturally, right? I didn't have a cell phone at her age. I didn't get a cell phone until I was like 28 years old. And the cell phone I got, I couldn't get on the internet. There was no Twitter. There was no Facebook. It was just a phone. And it cost me like 75 cents a minute to call somebody. It was a brick. And I can remember going off to cover the Big Ten conference in 1998, 1999. I'd be driving around the Midwest using GPS or a map. And I think to myself now, I didn't have the ability to just punch in an address and drive there with my car. I had to think about where I was going and where I was going to stay. And it was a little more complex, but also it was simpler. And I only bring this up because we have this story today about Eric Martin, NBA official, who may or may not have had a burner account. And according to the internet sleuths who are out there who track such things, they just seem to notice. And I watched this, I think 95.7 in the Bay Area, KNBR or whatever it's called in the Bay Area is whatever it's called now, is the first place I saw it. And the first place that I kind of started looking at it, and what they were reporting and showing was that, there seemed to be a Twitter account that was very defensive about the NBA officiating, and in particular, Eric Martin, NBA official. And some people on Twitter started to note it and then started calling out Eric Martin and saying, how long before the Twitter account gets deleted? And before it could be deleted, somebody did sort of screen record all of the replies and mentions. And I went through and I wasted about 4 minutes of my life watching that. And it did appear to be either Eric Martin or somebody who was advocating strongly on his behalf and on behalf of the officials in the NBA. And sort of clapping back at a lot of the noise on social media. And I have to think it would be really difficult to be an NBA general manager, to be, or let's just say a professional sports general manager or a coach or even a player who had to be in the position of chronically reading criticism of yourself and going, I can't speak back because it's going to be a bad look if I clap back. And also NBA officials who don't have social media watching social media and going, I wish I had an opportunity to kind of advocate on behalf of myself and other NBA officials and tell people what I know and explain how wrong people are and how these false narratives are being perpetuated. And, you know, some of this goes back to the fact that some people have thick skin and some don't. Like, I had a friend the other day. I wrote a column about Damian Lillard. I wrote a column that basically, you know my viewpoint on that. I don't believe the Blazers should mortgage their future, the number three draft pick, Anfernee Simons, Shaedon Sharpe, in exchange for trying to find a serviceable player to stick alongside Lillard that doesn't make an impact. Like, you tell me that the Blazers are going to have a shot to compete for a championship, and I'm listening. But if you're telling me they're making a move and mortgaging their future so they can have a shot to be a playoff team, I'm not doing that. And I told the barista today at Starbucks, who I was talking about this very topic, he asked me, what should the Blazers do with the pick? And I told the barista, I said, you do not mortgage your future for a guy who's going to be here for at most three or four more seasons, at most. 33 years old this summer. It's not personal. It's just not logical to me to give up the number three pick unless you get a player in return who's going to move the needle in a way that makes it a no-brainer. Like, I'm talking about it. Some other team has to be stupid to in order for me to listen to a trade for the number three pick. I'm making the pick because the number three pick should be part of your franchise plan, ideally, 5, 7, 10 years from now. So I'm not mortgaging that just to be a playoff team. You tell me I can compete better. But I have a friend who reaches out to me and says, hey, you know, you got some Blazer fans mad at you on Twitter. And A, I don't care. Okay? And I'm over that long ago. I don't care if you're mad. I don't care if you're happy. It does not validate me or invalidate me or make me feel good or make me feel bad or brighten my day or ruin my day if you agree or disagree with me. I think you're entitled for your opinion. Here's what I think. And I probably learned that long ago. I was covering Indiana basketball in Indiana. And I was writing critically what I thought about Bobby Knight. And the Indiana fans were like, we're not used to this outsider telling us what to do. And then what did I do after that? I lived in Tallahassee. Bobby Bowden was there. I went to cover Jerry Tarkanian in Fresno State and as a columnist, and you know, Tark was running that town. People were like, how dare you? How dare you criticize a native son of the Central Valley of California? How dare you? No matter if I was right or wrong. And at some point, you just kind of go, it's just white noise that what you get in return. But I can imagine if an NBA official or a general manager isn't kind of formally conditioned in that role, that it would be very difficult for those individuals to hear the criticism, and especially difficult if they felt like the public doesn't understand us. Remember, NBA officials are not allowed to make comment about their calls, about protocols. They're not allowed to, you know, sometimes they'll do a pool reporter who will visit the locker room and the official will give a statement, but they don't want, like, the officials running around making comment. Like, it would be chaotic. And so the officials probably feel muted. It's part of the job, but they feel muted. And so I would not be surprised if multiple NBA officials, Major League Baseball umpires, NFL referees, Pac-12 officials. Hell, I wrote the column today. This is a great example. I wrote a column today about Pac-12 baseball at johnconzano.com. Take a look at the comment section. Somebody drifted in there who claims to be a friend of a Pac-12 official who says, hey, there are good officials out there, and starts advocating pretty hard inside the comment section for, hey, you know, the Pac-12 officials aren't all bad. And I don't know. I read a few of the comments as I was going through because I do reply to the comments in there. And I thought to myself, that's either a Pac-12 official or it's somebody who knows a Pac-12 official well. And I feel the same about this Eric Martin Twitter account. It's either him or it's somebody who knows him well and knows officiating well enough to comment about it. And sure enough, what happened? The account was deleted. It was wiped. It's gone. NBA very likely investigating behind the scenes, probably asking Eric Martin, is this you? Produce your phone. Produce your IP address. We're going to, you know, the NBA, they've got former FBI and CIA agents, all the leagues do, working for them in investigative capacities, they will get to the bottom of this in the same way that they have previously got to the bottom of other officials who had Twitter accounts. I think it, you know, I would love to hear from the officials. I understand why the leagues don't let them talk. I would love to hear from general managers, and they do talk sometimes in formal press settings, but I kind of liked when, you know, we had the day of having some, like, you know, having some of the some of the general managers in the league with Twitter accounts who would openly kind of just tell us what they were thinking. And of course, we have a case of a general manager who was on his way to China who tweeted what he was thinking, got himself in hot water not that long ago. I just think it would surprise me if some of these individuals, or most of the individuals, didn't have some kind of burner account where they were watching. And I have friends who work in the legal world, in the court system, in law enforcement, who tell me they don't have social media, but they always know what's going on social media. And I guarantee you they're in there mixing it up with some fake handle, checking out what's going on. I don't understand. Here's another thing I don't understand about social media. And again, I'll go back to my children know more than I do. My kids, especially the 20-year-old, she's deft on Instagram. Okay, she's good. She's so good that she's got companies that, you know, seek her out and say, hey, help us understand how to engage with other people. They've hired her. This is a side hustle that she has in college. I didn't know anything about it. She one day we got a note from her and she said, hey, you're going to get a delivery of 10 pounds of coffee. She doesn't even drink coffee. I'm like, we're getting a delivery of coffee? She says, 10 pounds of coffee are coming to the house. And I said, okay, what am I supposed to do with this coffee? She says, you know, can you drop it off to me next time you're coming up and going to a football game at Oregon State? She goes to Oregon State. And I said, okay, I'll bring you the coffee. And I said to her, what are you doing with the coffee? And she says, oh, I'm helping the coffee company run their Instagram account. She's getting paid by it. Now, she didn't tell me this probably because she didn't want me to offset that money from what I give her monthly. I'm going to guess that's what it was really about. But she's working for several businesses in that capacity. And I think that kids her age have a better grasp, a better understanding of, you know, how to engage, how to connect, how to reach, how to grow audience. You know, the rest of us are kind of all have had to learn that. They have grown up with it. I don't necessarily have a problem if an NBA general manager, and I suspect general managers of the past in Portland have had burner accounts. I just, you know, I've got an inkling. Let's just say that. I suspect they've had burner accounts, and I'm okay with that. I think they should be entitled to hear what people are saying about them. I'm glad they don't want to be out of touch. I'm even okay if an umpire or an official has an account. What I don't want is I don't want them using it to manipulate the public or, you know, I think they should mostly be there for the discourse and to see what's being said. Although, I got to tell you, sometimes there's nothing to see. Sometimes it just makes you dumber. Steven, you've observed this kind of behavior in the wild. Kevin Durant had a burner account, got caught in that. If Eric Martin has a burner account, is there a danger in an official having a burner account?
I don't know. I don't think there's a problem. Because I will say, like, the officials, they aren't great in the NBA, but they get a worse rap than they should. They get blamed for a lot of things. They get blamed that they're rigging games and they're betting on games, and none of that is true. Tim Donaghy ruined all of it. And so I think for Eric Lewis, like, he probably hears that, and then there's these calls that are made, and then people go back on Twitter and they go through every single call that is made and one bad call, and then he wants to defend himself because he feels like, you know what, I'm doing the best I can. I'm not as bad as you think I am. You would be way worse than I am out there. So I'm going to defend myself. So I don't think it's necessarily a problem. I think it's a problem that he's getting caught. And the fact that, like, if you're going to go about it right, you can't be using the names, right? Like, he kept writing Eric Lewis as, you know, as that Twitter account. That's a real giveaway. Like, you can't be that specific when you do it.
He wasn't very good about it.
No, he wasn't very good at his burner account. Like, I don't think it's a problem because I do think, like, people should be able to defend themselves. But referees can't do that.
But the league doesn't want that.
The league
they don't
can't
want
have
anybody
that.
Talking.
And so I think that it is okay for them to get their thoughts out in a different manner if no one notices them.
Do you think, like, but you're listening, like, Twitter, you know, I looked at a study one time, and it was 70% of the tweets on Twitter are created by about 20% of the users, meaning it really is the definition of a vocal minority. Very vocal, but not a reflection of the public. And also, if you're on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, you are often getting fed by your algorithm and by the fact that you choose followers on those accounts. You're getting fed what you want to hear, not just what you're interested in. And so I think there's a danger there in groupthink that happens. And I could see an official like Eric Lewis believing that he really needs to get in there and set the record straight. But really, you know, what percentage of people is he really talking to? I mean, is he talking to like 50 people that feel very loud to him? Like, I don't understand that.
And that's the problem, is that I think on Twitter, a lot of time it's like a fan of a team. So like, there's no way you're ever going to convince them any other 100%. Way. So like, if there's a Heat fan and they call a foul on Jimmy Butler, like, and he defends it. Well, no, I'm a Heat fan. Jimmy Butler didn't foul him for sure. Like, so there's really no winning in that case, but at the same time, it would have to be hard to just hear how you're fixing games and you're betting on games and you're controlling the outcome of all these basketball games when, in fact, you're just doing your job and trying to do it the best of your ability.
I think there's also another factor here in that, you know, I just think some people are more built to withstand criticism than others. I find it interesting that a referee who gets booed in the stadium, booed unmercifully, in the stadium, nobody's cheering the referee on a game night, that a referee might just be finally tired enough of it to bark back a little bit and knows he can't clap back with the whistle.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.